Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In 2012, a massive fire ripped through the Chevron Richmond refinery, sending a towering plume of toxic smoke into the air over Richmond, California. For over 100 years, Richmond was a classic company town whose politics, economy, and environment were defined by Chevron and the pollution spewing from the refinery, which caught fire every few years. But as a result of a decade of grassroots organizing, the 2012 fire kindled a new resistance to Chevron's business as usual. This morning, we talk with Steve Early, whose new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, traces the community organizing and initiatives that are turning Richmond into one of the greenest and most progressive cities in America. Steve has worked as a journalist, lawyer, labor organizer, or union representative for the past 45 years. And he's on the show a couple of years ago talking about the 2014 very successful election in Richmond. So, Steve, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on, Barbara.
It's nice to have you here, live person in the studio.
Great to be in Portland.
Because Steve is here on a book tour right now, and I saw him last night at the Unitarian Church, and tonight he'll be speaking at the Portland State Bookstore at 7 o'clock, and we'll give you more information about that at the end of the show. Well, I got a response when I sent out the press release that I send out every week about the show, about calling Richmond one of the greenest cities in America. So I got a response from a friend of mine who moved to El Cerrito a couple of years ago, and she said, I don't think of Richmond as being green. So would you defend my statement?
Well, El Cerrito has a long history of being kind of a snobby neighbor and looking down on Richmond, even in its current, more progressive incarnation. As I note in the book, a snobby neighbor of El Cerrito, the mayor at one point described Richmond as the armpit of the Bay Area. And that was for a long time a view of the city. It was polluted, it was poverty-stricken, it was crime-ridden, it was a place to be avoided. Its city hall had a reputation for corruption and dysfunction, crony-style politics. And, of course, Chevron, operating in the city for more than a century, was the dominant employer and political influence. That's changed a lot in the last 10 to 15 years, as I point out in the book. I think any city that has a major oil refinery, which pollutes both the environment and its local politics, can hardly be described as 100% green. But in one key area, community choice aggregation, a lot of people in Richmond, very high percentage, are now getting their power rather than through traditional sources via Pacific Gas and Electric, but through Marin Clean Energy, which is a program serving five or six East Bay communities. So a lot of consumers of electricity are definitely shopping around for the greener option. And there's a lot of environmental consciousness in the community. And it's a poor community. It's not upper middle class. It's not a university town. You know, it's a 80% non-white, poor and working class city with, I think, a lot of affection for green initiatives and a lot of popular support for them.
Well, somebody else said to me a number of years ago, and I was spending a lot of time down in Richmond working on our film that features Urban Tilth, Urban Ag program in Richmond, which is quite inspiring. And this person said to me, isn't Richmond the Detroit of the West Coast? And actually, I thought, I mean, that's, besides being a very derogative term, actually, Urban Tilth at that time had just visited Detroit and connected with their whole urban farming program in Detroit. So I was thinking, well, in some positive ways, yes, because I think when we look at some of these communities that are really stressed and marginalized and abused by industry and left to just kind of deteriorate, that these new seeds start to take off. And literally, like in the case of all the gardening in Detroit or Urban Tilth and all the other wonderful urban gardens and farms in Richmond, there is this like the seedbed that's really coming into its own.
Yeah. And as you documented, Urban Tilth is a great, great program in terms of involving young people in urban agriculture, teaching better eating habits in schools and getting people doing hands-on work. You know, Richmond's Main Street, McDonald Avenue, still looks like desolate stretches of Cleveland, Youngstown, Detroit in its most battered neighborhoods. But I'd rather see some chickens pecking around and some vegetables growing in a vacant lot than just the vacant lot. Someday, maybe we'll have both urban gardens and more thriving downtown businesses. That's the objective of the current city administration and part of the city's long-term effort to revive itself.
Well, actually, McDonald has a new development, relatively new development. Yep. I remember it kind of going up while we were making our film.
Yep.
So let's talk about, before we get into the bright side of the Richmond story, and interestingly, the last two election cycles, which were so depressing everywhere in the country except in Richmond, and we'll talk about why that happened. But I wanted to talk about the refinery fire in 2012. That you moved to Richmond just a few months before the fire. Actually, I was kind of curious why you moved to Richmond and how aware were you of the refinery when you moved to Richmond?
Well, like many recent blow-ins on that section of the East Bay, Richmond housing prices are surprisingly affordable. And we moved from Boston 5 years ago. Really, obviously, couldn't find anything affordable in San Francisco. Even Berkeley and Oakland are, you know, pricing many people out of the market. We knew some people in Richmond. Parts of it are really beautiful, and it's a very welcoming community. A lot going on. And so the combination of that and affordable housing was, you know, a good match for us. But, you know, buried in the big pile of real estate paperwork were certain disclaimers about our industrial neighbor on the other side of the hill. We live on a dead-end street, and the Chevron property starts at the end of the street. So you're aware of it, but you become more aware of it when 6 months after you move in, due to lax, shoddy, negligent maintenance practices, a pipe leak led to an ignition, explosion, a huge towering plume of toxic smoke, a major fire in the refinery that sent 15,000 downwind refinery neighbors scrambling for medical attention at every emergency room and clinic in the area. So it was a major event and a pivotal event in terms of people once again questioning the company's safety record, both in the workplace and in the community, its influence in local politics, and its impact on the local environment and, of course, global warming.
Now, were you aware after the 2012 fire happened that there had been one in 2007? There was one in 1999. I happened to be around for that one, too, which I found it interesting. For me, like, I go down to the Bay Area pretty regularly, but I'm not there all the time. And to have experienced two fires in a period of about 13 years, I thought was, I can't think of any place else I go on a regular basis where I've experienced two refinery fires.
Well, your timing was good. And no, we were blissfully ignorant. I only became aware of this long history of environmental misconduct recidivism when I was researching the book Refinery Town. And it is pretty appalling how many of these so-called accidents have occurred. And as both the Steelworkers Union, which represents refinery operators, and the Chemical Safety Board documented, this was an avoidable incident. The company had known for more than 10 years about the problems with this stretch of pipe in its refinery complex, had postponed maintenance, part of a long history and pattern of the company putting production and profits ahead of worker safety and community health.
Well, the other thing that I learned shortly after the fire, because at that time I was working, besides working on our film about urban ag and sustainable ag, I was also working on projects around tar sands. And I heard rumors that there was a plan to be able to process tar sands oil at the refinery if they could do the upgrade, and that the community had fought this modernization plan because they didn't want the tar sands being processed. So question number one, were you aware of that there was this, that was the debate, and that in fact the this thing is Chevron blamed the community for opposing their modernization plan and blamed the fire on them. But also, I'm wondering if you are aware of the potential for them to be able to process tar sands oil.
Well, they continue to disavow this as their intent, long-term or short-term. There is a $1 billion modernization project underway right now in the Richmond Chevron refinery that, according to the company, is going to make it cleaner and safer. We'll see. As part of the process of getting city approval for that project, the city was able to extract some financial benefits, a $90 million community benefits package, which is going to fund various needed programs, including a scholarship program for Richmond High School kids. It's a never-ending tug of war with the company. People have to keep the pressure on it through the Bay Area Air Quality Management Board, which monitors its emissions, through the Cal OSHA rulemaking process that's been going on for 4.5 years to try to strengthen refinery safety rules. And of course, you know, we're now faced with the problem of Trump wanting to abolish any federal agency that has any semblance of regulatory authority, including the Chemical Safety Board, which really only can investigate fires and explosions and make recommendations, has no rulemaking or enforcement authority. But he wants to get rid of that, too.
So how did Richmond transform itself from a company town where the government, city government, was completely dominated and bought and paid for by Chevron to now having one of the most progressive city governments in the country?
Well, the progressives in Richmond who started to coalesce into the Richmond Progressive Alliance 13 or 14 years ago were really up against not only big oil, but a broader and more typical coalition of conservative forces. Chevron had allies, the Chamber of Commerce, the Manufacturers Association, local developers, also big campaign donors and an influence in city life, conservative building trades unions who allied themselves with the developers and Chevron, and conservative police and firefighter unions. So some elements of that coalition I know are very familiar to environmentalists and more progressive labor activists, community organizers who butted heads with one or more of the above. The progressives came together. They'd been involved in various local single-issue campaigns, figured they would be stronger and more effective if they united around a common agenda for municipal reform, and started running candidates. So they had some people on the inside rather than just mobilizing the community from the outside. And so the first breakthrough was the election of Gail McLaughlin as a city council member in 2004. 2 years later, she became, for 8 years, the Green mayor of Richmond, making Richmond the largest city in the country to have a Green Party member mayor serving as mayor. And since 2004, the Progressive Alliance has elected or won 10 out of 16 mayoral and city council races that it's entered. Pretty good batting average, and now represents 5 out of 7 members of the current Richmond City Council.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Steve Early, who's just written a book called Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, about Richmond, California, and its transformation from being a refinery town and under the thumb of Chevron to being a real progressive force in California's Bay Area. One of the big issues with Chevron and being up against Chevron is the immense amount of money that they have, though I understand in the beginning, and according to Andre Soto, one of your colleagues in Richmond and the head of the Community for Better Environment, he was talking about how they would spend a few thousand dollars, basically, for elections back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, pennies for them. Mm-hmm. The costs seemed to increase as the progressive organized. But how was it possible for progressives to counter all the money that Chevron was able to throw at elections and to throw for their own candidates and against the progressive candidates?
Just about the money thing, that's definitely changed because of the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United. Individual candidates' donations to them are limited, whether it's a person giving them or a union or a corporation, to $2,500 for municipal candidates in California. Since Citizens United, of course, so-called independent expenditure committees can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, on a candidate, supposedly independently without coordination, but basically promoting them and attacking whoever they're running against. So over the last three election cycles, a combination of Big Soda, Big Oil, and last fall, the landlord lobby spent $7 to $8 million trying to defeat progressive candidates in Richmond and elect conservative, corporate-friendly Democrats for the most part. To counter that, the Richmond Progressive Alliance had to build a very strong grassroots organization, a canvassing capacity, recruit hundreds of volunteers every election year for door knocking, had to function as a year-round organization. It's a membership group. People pay dues. They have an elected leadership. They organize around issues year in and year out. It doesn't just pop up at election time. And people run together, rejecting business donations, as a slate, as a team, as a ticket. So people are voting not just for an individual good government candidate, but for one, two, or three, four people who are committed to a common program of reform. And that is a way of holding the people that we elect much more accountable than in many other situations.
So what does it look like? What's like your game plan on the ground?
Well, right now, one of the big challenges, and I know this is an issue here in Portland, is implementing effective rent regulation. Last fall, after 12 years of pursuing this goal, progressives in Richmond got a ballot measure calling for rent control. It was adopted by the voters 2-1 for making Richmond the first city in about 30 years to reintroduce rent regulation. As a result of that vote, rents were rolled back to 2015 levels. Future increases are going to be limited to the overall cost of living, and landlords now cannot evict tenants without just cause, and there's going to be a rent board that's going to adjudicate landlord-tenant disputes. California, fortunately, unlike Oregon, Washington State, Massachusetts, other supposedly liberal places, does still permit cities to introduce rent regulation. I think this was an issue that affected literally thousands of low-income Black and Latino tenants who otherwise would have been at risk of being displaced. And it was a great victory for the movement and helped elect two additional progressives to the city council.
Well, this sort of brings me back to some of the issues around the 2014 election, because I've been talking to you and some other people in Richmond leading up to the election in 2014, and people were really dispirited because of the millions of dollars at Chevron. You called it the air war, but that there was all this money being poured into the candidates, particularly Nat Bates, who was running for mayor, and supporting the Chevron slate and really smearing the progressive slate. But I didn't understand until I came back later to find out that the progressive slate wasn't all Richmond Progressive Alliance people. There were some liberal Democrats involved, including Tom Bates, who ran for mayor against Nat Bates. Tom Budd, who ran against Nat Bates. Well, I had an opportunity to interview Tom last summer. And one of the things, I thought we'd finished the interview. I asked him the usual question, do you have anything else you want to add? I got a 10-minute earful about how bad rent control was. And I realized this isn't a very interesting alliance. I'm wondering how has it been working since 2014? I know it's going to be different now, but how did it work from 2014 to the present with the fact that there was not a consensus around every issue between the Richmond Progressive Alliance and your allies?
Well, you know, whether it's the Portland City Council with Chloe Udaly trying to, I'm sure, build coalitions with other people in the council to get tenant protection passed, Shama Sawant in Seattle, a left-wing tribune of the people on their city council, you know, for her to get anything passed, she has to have liberal Democratic allies. So on some issues, the progressives in Richmond, since they never had a majority until just this January, had to form issue coalitions, alliances with liberal Democrats on the council, like Tom Budd, who are very good on environmental issues, good on money and politics, good on community choice aggregation, you know, clean energy. But on issues, labor issues, raising the minimum wage, and regulating rents, they take a much more conservative corporate Democrat type stance. So, Tom, you know, told people 2 years ago he was against rent control, and people, you know, worked with him as an ally for other reasons having to do with the need to form a united front that could defeat the Chevron-backed candidates. Then, if he doesn't shape up on the issue of rent control, he's going to face a challenger in 2 years and could be one of the people that won last fall.
Well, he actually sort of surprised me when I was talking to him last summer when we were talking about the health impacts of the refinery and the health impacts of the 2012 fire in particular. And he said, well, 15,000 people went to the hospital, but we don't know, you know, how many of them were really sick and how many of them were going because that was the way you get money out of Chevron. And there was a certain kind of cynical tone to it. And he said, well, I don't know, they could have really been sick, but it really distressed me that was kind of coming from him, from somebody who sees himself as such a strong opponent of Chevron's hegemony over the community.
Well, I'm sure the Chevron lawyers, and Chevron is very good at lawyering up, will be using that statement in defending the lawsuit that Tom and others,
actually,
city council members.
I'm not putting it in my documentary. I mean, I was editing that
section.
The
city is suing Chevron in a lawsuit that was filed a year after the fire on a very different theory, that both the people in the city suffered substantial health and financial negative impacts 3.5 years later, we're not even through the discovery stage. Chevron's very good at dragging out environmental litigation. So that was not a helpful comment because the city budget and bottom line could definitely benefit from an infusion of Chevron settlement money. But the Ecuadorian case is any guide, could be years off.
Well, did he actually say that publicly? Because the other thing he said in that interview was what he thought the real basis of the lawsuit was the drop in property values.
Yes, it's the complaint covers a number of losses that the city incurred, and the immediate impact, negative impact, was a precipitous decline in local property taxes, which exacerbated the problem of the city's tax base. Already, we have a problem where big commercial taxpayers, and this is a state problem in California, don't pay their fair share. This big loophole created by Proposition 13 back in the late 1970s. And, you know, Chevron pays much less than it should based on the current value of its operations and its property in California and Richmond. So, we'll see where the lawsuit over the fire ends up. In the meantime, the company still hasn't paid its CalOSHA fines. The company is very good at paying its fair share, whether it's property taxes, manufacturer's taxes, utility taxes, fines or penalties for its environmental misconduct.
You're saying it is good or it's not good at paying its fair share?
It's very good at avoiding, at evading, dragging out, settling short.
Because I talked with Claire Brown last summer, who's an economist at UC Berkeley, and she was saying, she sort of, in an economist's way, spelled out in great detail to me how Chevron avoided paying its fair share of property taxes. And it has a lot to do with Prop 13 that goes back, to 1977 or 78? And explain that.
Well, in the late 70s, homeowners were feeling the squeeze, and they got a state referendum passed that was designed to reduce property taxes for individual homeowners. But over the nearly 40 years since then, it's created huge loopholes for big commercial property owners like Chevron. Their property is still assessed based on pre-1978 values. If Chevron was paying taxes today at the rate or under the formula that existed pre-Proposition 13, the state of California would have an additional $250 million a year in revenue. And locally, we'd have $30 million to improve parks and recreation and other city programs and to avoid city worker layoffs and fund city employee pensions, do lots of things that are very difficult for the city to do because it has an annual struggle to close a budget deficit.
Well, let's get to the 2016 election. We didn't go into the whole emotional roller coaster of the 2014 one, though I remember hearing, I think I heard on election night, that you'd had very good results and that the Chevron slate had been just tumultuously defeated. And it was after looking around the country at all kinds of defeats. We had a defeat here. We were trying to get GMOs labeling passed, and that didn't happen. And we did legalize marijuana. That was, I guess. And also, gay marriage became legal that year. So there are some good things that happened in 2014. But overall, I think in November 2014, it was a pretty bleak year politically across the country, and except in Richmond. Now, I'd say in 2016, it's even been more dramatically that way. And I wonder how you balance what happened nationally politically on November 2016 and what happened in Richmond.
Well, I think the results certainly nationally in the general election on November 8th were pretty dismal in most places, but there was a positive aspect to the 2015-16 election cycle. That was Bernie Sanders' campaign. He inspired a lot of young people to get involved in his effort and post-Sanders campaign to run for elected office in many places around the country with support from his post-campaign organization, Our Revolution. Last fall, Richmond elected its youngest city council member ever, 26-year-old African-American rent control campaign organizer Melvin Willis, who was inspired to run by Bernie's campaign, was endorsed by Bernie. Bernie helped him and another RPA candidate raise $5,000 for their respective efforts. Both of them were strong supporters of rent control, and they placed first and second in a field of nine. And among the losers was the candidate, longtime city council incumbent that you mentioned earlier, Nat Bates, for 40 years, conservative African-American Democrat backed by Chevron, opposed to all forms of progress in Richmond. He was defeated by 2,000 votes by a 26-year-old African-American Bernie supporter. So the times are changing in Richmond. There's a generational shift, and we're seeing an influx of younger people, Black, Latino, some Asian, inspired by Bernie's campaign, and they're taking that spirit local and getting more engaged in the community, and some of them are running for office themselves.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Steve Early, who has written a new book called Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, talking about big changes in Richmond, California over the last 12, 14 years. What do you see now as the where you see Richmond going in the light of now you have a progressive supermajority on city council? And at the same time, we are facing the strangest presidency. And I was just reading today that there's no doubt that Donald Trump is on record as being the most corrupt president of the United States ever in only 2 months.
Well, Richmond, leading the way as usual, has already passed a council resolution unanimously calling for impeachment proceedings, resolutionary activity at best, but making a statement, and I'm sure other communities will be joining them before long. The challenge of Trump obviously is that federal programs are going to be cut back even more in Richmond, even under Obama. Funds for public housing dried up over the course of 8 years. So again, that puts more pressure on progressives in City Hall when they're dealing with new development projects in Richmond or any place to ensure that there's linkage fees that are going to enable the city within its limited resources to build more affordable housing. We need that, not just rent control, though rent control is an important defensive measure. I think the biggest threat really in many states is the state and federal government trying to retaliate against rebel cities, against progressive mayors and city councils. We've already seen evidence of that in threats to withhold law enforcement grants from cities or counties that declare themselves to be sanctuary cities or counties. And I'm sure there's going to be other attempted forms of retaliation as well. So, you know, places like Richmond, places like Portland, they have to start developing allies and a stronger grassroots movement, not just in the form of direct action resistance, which is incredibly important, but also more successful electoral initiatives at the local and state level.
Well, I'm thinking about the cover of The Nation magazine a couple weeks ago. It's a picture of Donald Trump, and across it was three pieces of tape, Washington, Oregon, and California. and basically the idea that there's this big resistance. We call it here in the Northwest the Thin Green Line. Well, that's the environmental part of it, but it's more than that. It's really about the resistance to this proto-fascism that's emanating from Washington, D.C. now, and that has definitely strongholds around the country. And it's also standing up for some values and trying to move forward. And I think this alliance would have been there whether Clinton had won or Trump had won. This has something to do, it's bigger than either party, national party.
But in each of these three blue states, you don't have to go far to find activists, former Bernie supporters, who are very unhappy with the behavior of corporate Democrats in the state legislatures of those three states, or governors, who are still very susceptible to the influence of big money in politics, including the influence of big oil. And yes, it's great that these folks in states like California are standing up against Trump, but they also need to stand up against some of the special interests that have long held too much sway over our own state legislators.
Well, right now I'm feeling pretty good about the three attorney generals in those three states, not so great about the governors. And I mean, here in the Northwest, Governor Jay Inslee in Washington, it's up to him to decide whether the North America's largest oil by rail terminal is going to be built in Vancouver right across the river from here. And everything points to looking like he's going to veto it, but he hasn't said it yet. And I guess there's some legal reasons why he can't.
This is the Tesoro project.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I can tell you from the experience of oil workers and refinery neighbors in Contra Costa County that Tesoro, which operates a big refinery in Martinez, California, is not a good neighbor. Perhaps an even worse one than Chevron, and that's a low bar.
Actually, Tesoro has a very bad record in Anacortes. I mean, the 2012 fire in Richmond was only outshone by this fire in Anacortes, which actually killed, I think, 12 people. And like the one in Richmond, jacked the price of gas up in the Northwest for many months. And that was Tesoro. So I think that that's the other thing, too. It's kind of like when people are always talking about Monsanto and forget about Syngenta and Bayer and all the other bad players that we can yell at Chevron, but Tesoro, which is not as well known, probably has a worse safety record.
Well, one of the bright spots in the book and in recent Bay Area blue-green alliance building was this strike by steelworkers 2 years ago at Tesoro in Martinez, California, part of a nationwide oil industry contract campaign involving 30,000 workers around the country. And that got very strong community support, solidarity from Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, 350.org. Environmentalists came to the picket lines. They supported the oil workers. And I think a lot of striking refinery workers realized, some of them for the first time, that the environmental movement can be an ally. There is a common interest in making the refinery safer for the workers and healthier for the communities where they're located, as difficult as that is. And if people don't work together, the companies are just going to win through traditional divide-and-conquer strategies that Chevron has been very good at pursuing for more than 100 years in Richmond, anyway.
Well, another concern that is often raised, and you refer in your book to the Richmond Progressive Alliance being called by Chevron and Chevron's allies in the black community, the Richmond Plantation Alliance. How well does the Progressive Alliance represent communities of color in Richmond? Because Richmond, as you said, is 80% non-white, but it seems like there's a lot of white people running the, or at least were running the Progressive Alliance.
Well, in the last 2 years, as I report in the book, the Richmond Progressive Alliance has reorganized, developed a much more internally democratic and diverse elected leadership structure. The current steering committee of 28 people is majority women, people of color, much younger than in the past. Some of the founding mothers and fathers of the organization have, to their credit, stepped back and allowed other younger activists to move into leadership positions. Four out of the five progressives on the city council are people of color, two Mexican-Americans, two African-Americans, excuse me, a Mexican-American and a Korean-American. One of the African-Americans identifies as a black Latina lesbian, but, you know, in the identity politics, reverse dog whistle politics world of Richmond, she's often been denounced sometimes as not being a real African-American because, you know, she came from Panama. So the way the race card has been played by corporate-backed African-American opponents of the progressive movement in Richmond is quite vicious. And but I think younger people aren't buying it anymore. It's not working, and we saw the results of it not working last fall with who was elected and who wasn't.
Well, I was thinking about a conversation I had with Andre Soto last summer, and he was talking about how Richmond started out being controlled, started out being controlled by Chevron because Chevron was there before the city was incorporated. And for many, many years, the Richmond was run by white people that were all in the pocket of Chevron. But then when the city became majority African-American, then Chevron bought out the African-Americans. And then when Latinos moved in, they bought out the Latinos. So is there a counterforce now?
Very definitely. But, you know, this co-optation process is one that I'm sure people are familiar with anywhere where the what's often called the nonprofit industrial complex operates. Chevron is not just the biggest employer, the biggest taxpayer in Richmond. It's also the biggest philanthropist. It's very skillful at spreading millions of dollars around, lavishing money on much-needed social programs, children's breakfast programs, the Police Athletic League, after-school programs, all kinds of good nonprofit activity, but it's a way of buying influence and loyalty and winning hearts and minds. And that, you know, is not a substitute for paying your fair taxes and having elected, democratically elected city leaders decide what the priority should be in terms of social spending in a city. But they want to maintain the status quo of paying less in taxes and engaging in strategic philanthropy that's a supplement to their attempted political string pulling.
You sound a little bit like the Black Panthers for a minute, the old Black Panther Party in the 60s, pre-breakfast with children.
Well, funny you mentioned the Black Panther Party, because it's part of Black History Month. Just a couple of weeks ago, at a Chevron-funded children's breakfast program in a low-income housing project in Richmond, who was the Chevron-sponsored speaker? None other than Bobby Seale of the Black Panther Party, who, when the Panthers in 1967 first started a breakfast program in North Richmond, it was not funded by Standard Oil, Chevron's predecessor. And so the company's very good at bringing in people who are icons in the Black community or respected elders. Willie Brown, former mayor of San Francisco, Andy Young, civil rights leader, and Bobby Seale was not in this category, but certainly some of the other speakers that they have funded have definitely brought in to promote the Chevron message that we got to keep these environmentalists on a short lease because otherwise we'll have no jobs, no growth, no community prosperity, and people of color will be somehow harmed by the progressive agenda.
Well, Bobby Seale, I know he's a big supporter of urban tilth. And he and I friended each other on Facebook when I first got involved with urban tilth. So I saw that he has some Richmond ties. I wonder if he could be pulled into like creating, with the help of the Richmond Progressive Alliance and other groups, alternative free breakfast programs for children and free health care and whatever else, the kinds of programs that the Panthers were running in the 60s. Because it seems like if there were a progressive force that was providing these services, it might undercut what Chevron was doing.
Yeah, and there are nonprofits and community service programs in Richmond that operate independent of corporate influence. But it's fundraising is hard. And when a big benefactor is ready to write you a check, I mean, most people will take it and, you know, say that they're independent of the company's views on other issues. But sometimes it's more complicated than that.
I know that Urban Tilth is very proudly independent from Chevron, and they laid out to us, and we were asking them about any, would they accept Chevron money, and it was like, absolutely not. Occasionally, they work in collaboration with organizations that are accepting Chevron money, and they can't do much about that. It sort of sounds to me like they have the same position as the Richmond Progressive Alliance in terms of running candidates.
Yep.
How many groups are there like Urban Tilth?
Not many. It is the exception, a principled minority.
And they're struggling, too, all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to let people know about your presentation tonight at Portland State. So what's going to be happening tonight at Portland State Bookstore?
Well, I think we're going to have a good exchange about progressive politics in Portland and Richmond and the lessons of here and there. The Working Families Party, Labor Notes, the Adjunct Faculty Union, a whole constellation of co-sponsors, and it's at 7 o'clock. We're going to be selling copies of the book, and will mainly be a discussion and exchange about labor and community-based strategies for progressive electoral politics. Members of the Tenants Union are going to be there, I think, celebrating their recent city council gains here around tenant protection, environmentalists. Everybody's invited, former Bernie supporters.
Actually, and just about rent control, I have the understanding that there is now a bill, at least one bill, in front of the Oregon legislature that would overturn the rent control prohibition and also set up a whole process for no evictions except for just cause, and then the just cause would be defined. So I think that there's a possibility Oregon may be moving in the same direction as California.
Right. Well, I think the more cities do this, it puts pressure on state legislators to provide more support for local initiatives rather than imposing curbs on them or bans on your ability to raise the minimum wage or police the environment or protect immigrants or reform the police or do anything else.
Well, so the event tonight is at the Portland State Bookstore. It's 1715 Southwest Fifth Avenue. It's in the plaza.
In the bookstore itself.
Right, yeah. And there's a name for that plaza that is part of. But
It's the Student Center, I believe.
Right. So you can see Steve Early in the flesh tonight and get to see his book. His book is called Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of American City. And it's a very interesting read for those of you who have just thought of Richmond as pass-by.
Or the armpit of the Bay Area.
Or the place where you have to go through to get from the East Bay over to Marin or something like that, but which is what I used to think of it. And I'm really happy to have been acquainted with a very thriving and bustling, vibrant city.
It's been great to have you down there recording its local progress.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck with everything, and good luck with resistance to Trump.
You too.
We've been talking this morning with Steve Irwin, who's author of Refinery Town, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Jonathan White, author of Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Curtis Mayfield and The Impressions. Thanks for listening.
Keep all the pushing. Keep all the pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. Mm-hmm. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Now maybe someday, I'll reach that higher goal. I know I can make it with just a little bit of soul. 'Cause I've got my strength.